Good morning. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time now is 2 minutes after 9 a.m., January 23rd, 2020. I want to remind everybody to shut their cell phones down so we have less interruptions. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Wilson, Senator Wilikowski, and we're joined by Senate President Diesel. We today are going to have a review of the revenue sources for the state for the upcoming fiscal year, talk a little bit about the current fiscal year and other things. This presentation will be followed in a couple of weeks with order of operations presentation, which where we'll go into more detail dealing with the oil revenue side, particularly the severance tax and other credits and how the royalty components, how it all fits together. So today we'll spend a little bit of time on the oil side because it is such a heavy portion of our revenue, but this presentation today will be broader than the upcoming one. And we have with us today Acting Commissioner Mike Barnhill. If he can come forward, he has Acting Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, and he has a backup that he will be up to him when, and I guess he's already signaling for lifelines. So we will bring up Mr. Dan Stickle. He's Director of Economic Research Group, which the community, our committees are very familiar with, along with Colleen Grover, Director of the Tax Division. And maybe since this is the first time the three of you have been here this year, before you start, you can introduce yourself and give the public kind of a brief history of your work background, how long you've worked for the various departments or what have you in the state, because none of you are new to this table in the presentations. And we will have some members of the public that have not had the opportunity to watch Department of Revenue lay out the revenue sources for the state before. So if you can introduce yourself, Mr. Barnhill, and take the committee through the presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Happy New Year. My name is Mike Barnhill. Today I am here as Acting Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, joined, as you said, by Mr. Stickle, our Chief Economist, and Colleen Glover, the Director of our Tax Division. They're more than support or lifeline, Mr. Chair. They're actually going to be presenting today. I am here primarily to answer questions, granular level questions related to the tax credit bonding program, if the committee wishes to go there. I will let the committee know that tomorrow you'll be hearing from Devin Mitchell, our debt manager, and he has more slides on tax credit bonding program. And so we can discuss them today, we can discuss it tomorrow, it's up to the committee, or both. As far as my background goes, I am a lawyer by trade. I started working for the state of Alaska in 1998 for the Department of Law. I worked there through the end of 2010 when I joined the Parnell administration as deputy commissioner for the Department of Administration. Was there for 4 years in the Walker administration. I worked at the Office of Management Budget, Department of Administration, and finally Department of Revenue. I also sought credentials to be a chartered financial analyst, and I completed those tests last year. And I don't have the designation yet, but hopefully in the fullness of time I will get that. And today I'm here as Acting Commissioner of Department of Revenue. I think that's going to be temporary, but nevertheless, it's an honor to be before you today.
Thank you. Mr. Stickle, who are you?
Sure. Mr. Chairman Dan Stickle, I'm Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. I grew up in Juneau, lived in Alaska most of my life. I've been with the Economic Research Group since 2004. And I've been in the chief economist role since 2016.
And for those watching at home, Mr. Stickle has spent many meetings over several years in my office going over the minute details of the severance tax and the intricacies potential problems, misunderstandings, different interpretations, different modeling scenarios. So Mr. Stickel has been very involved in that. He's been very helpful to the chairman along with the committee to try to get as clear understanding of the data that and information that the department works with, because a lot of it is confidential and he has to commingle it and then deliver it to the legislature in an understandable format, which sometimes is very challenging because there's a lot of intricacies which will be laid out in more detail probably in the next meeting when we do the order of operations. So we're looking forward to Mr. Stickel coming back for that. Ms. Glover.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Colleen Glover. I've been with the state of Alaska for the last 3 years and as a TAC director for the last year, and before that, commercial analyst for both Department of Revenue and Department of Natural Resources Division of Oil and Gas. Before that, I worked for Alaska Pipeline for 20 years in operations, business planning, and oil movement. So the majority of my career was spent in oil and gas industry.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, before we start, I realize I made an omission in my resume, and I know that won't go unobserved, and so I worked last year for the Office of Management and Budget.
You should be proud of that. That's a good department, and I've been here many times. Not quite a department, but.
So with that, we'll hand it over to Mr. Stickel.
Actually, we're glad you're in the position you're in, Mr. Barnhill, some of us.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. Mr. Stickel.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, Dan Stickel with Department of Revenue. So I believe I'm going to go through most of the presentation. I will hand it over to Director Glover when we get to the section that talks about tax credits and audits. So the goal of this presentation is to give a high-level overview of the state revenue forecast, which underlies the governor's proposed budget. We'll touch on the major drivers of the oil revenue forecast in particular, as that is one of the largest sources of state revenue. And as you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, we'll save some of the more nuanced detail for a future committee presentation. And then once we go through the main forecast presentation, we have some additional slides at the end in an addendum that address some specific requests that came from the committee. So slide 3 shows total state revenue forecast for fiscal year 2019, as well as the forecast for fiscal year 20 and fiscal year 2021. Total state revenue is forecast stable at around $11 billion per year. We present state revenue in 4 broad categories consistent with budget documents. There's unrestricted revenue, unrestricted general fund revenue, which is available for appropriation by the legislature for any purpose. This is the subject of most budget discussions, as it is the most discretionary revenue source. Unrestricted general fund revenue was about $5.4 billion in fiscal year 19 and is forecast at just over $5 billion in both fiscal year 20 and fiscal year 2021. And most of the forecast presentation you see here and most of the budget debate centers around this unrestricted general fund revenue category. The other 3 revenue categories are designated general fund. This is technically available for appropriation, but these revenues in designated general fund are customarily appropriated for different sources. An example is a portion of the alcohol tax revenue that is customarily appropriated for alcohol and drug abuse treatment and prevention. Then there's the other restricted revenue category. These revenues are less available, less discretionary in nature. There's debt covenants, constitutional provisions, or other provisions that put a firmer restriction on how those revenues are used. And then finally, federal revenue. All federal receipts have some provisions from the federal government and how those revenues can be used. Slide 4 shows total state revenue in visual terms. You can see that investment earnings, federal revenue, and oil and gas are the largest sources of state revenue. Investment earnings are the largest source with about 36%, making up about 36% of state revenue. Most of this comes from the permanent fund, a large portion of which has been considered unrestricted revenue since fiscal year 2019. Federal revenue makes up about one-third of total state revenue, and federal revenue is fairly stable from year to year, is entirely considered restricted revenue. Oil and gas makes up about one-quarter of total revenue, a larger portion of the unrestricted revenue. And while other industries outside of investment, federal, and petroleum are very important to the state economy, all other revenue sources combine to make up only about 10% of total state revenue. Thus, the focus on investment in oil and gas and a lot of the revenue discussions.
Before you go to the next slide, give us a little insight on the investment earnings, the 36.2%. Is that, how is that calculated with dealing with the permanent fund?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So the 36.2% represents the share of the $11.1 billion of total revenue that is attributed to investment in particular. If we go back to slide three, you can see that investment earnings fall into a few different categories. The unrestricted portion, which was $2.8 billion in fiscal year 19, that is primarily the permanent fund transfer to the general fund. Under designated, that's some other treasury management funds. And then the $1.1 billion of other restricted investment revenue represents both earnings on the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund as well as any permanent fund earnings above and beyond the transfer to the general fund.
And the transfers, using the percent of market value of?
Correct, Mr. Chairman. And we have a few slides on that dives into permanent fund calculation in particular.
Okay, we'll wait for that.
So moving on to slide five. Slide five focuses on the unrestricted portion of petroleum revenue in particular, which is one of the main drivers of the unrestricted general fund forecast. This category of revenue brought in $2 billion in fiscal year 2019, is expected to decline to $1.6 billion in fiscal year 20 and $1.4 billion in fiscal year 2021. The main sources of unrestricted petroleum revenue start with the state share of the property tax, which brought in $119.5 million in fiscal year 19. We're seeing this revenue source as fairly stable with new investments offsetting depreciation of existing infrastructure on the property tax base. Corporate income tax brought in $217.7 million in fiscal year 19. We're also forecasting relative stability in this revenue source based on the expectation that companies are figuring out how to make profits under the current price levels. We had a few years in the 2016-2017 range where companies saw losses that reduced corporate income tax revenues, and we think that companies are going to be fairly stable in their corporate payments going forward. Production, oil and gas production tax, which brought in just under $600 million in fiscal year 19, we see that decreasing to about $300 to $400 million per year over the next several years. The reasons for that are a lower price forecast, a slightly lower production forecast, and significantly higher investment by the companies, which put us firmly in the minimum tax regime for production tax purposes. And in a few slides later in the presentation, we'll dive into a little bit more detail on what that means. Then the largest source of unrestricted petroleum revenue is royalties. Unrestricted royalties amounted to $1.1 billion in fiscal year 19. We do see that decreasing to a little under $850 million in fiscal year 20 and then about $750 million in fiscal year 2021. The reasons for the decline are threefold. First, lower price and lower production in the forecast reduced the value of oil subject to royalty. Second, a growing share of production is occurring on land that is not subject to state royalty. And third, our revenue forecast assumes that the full statutory amount of royalties is deposited into the permanent fund for fiscal year 20 and 21, which reduces the amount that's considered unrestricted revenue in the forecast.
Before we get to questions, we have Senator Wilkowski and Senator Hoffman, but for the public, could you give us a brief explanation on the deposit to the permanent fund on the royalties? There's a statute and there's a constitutional obligation.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, so under the state constitution, the permanent fund receives 25% of all royalties and related revenues from minerals, which includes oil and gas as well as mining, any mining royalties. There's a statute that provides that for leases issued post 1980, an additional 25% of royalties is deposited to the permanent fund. So for those leases under statute, 50% of the royalties are deposited to the permanent fund. The net effect of the leases that are subject to that statute and not subject to that statute, if the statute is followed, about 30% of petroleum royalties end up deposited to the permanent fund. And if we just follow the constitutional dedication, it's 25%. And so that difference amounts to about $75 million in fiscal year 20 and $68 million in fiscal year 21.
And that was just a reminder of an issue that will come back to the table later on in the budgetary process and possibly even the order of operations. It's been in the table, at the middle of the table the last couple of years. As we struggle with the funding to the statutory obligation of the royalties. So I just thought that'd be a good reminder.
Yeah, and to be clear, Mr. Chairman, in fiscal year 19, only the constitutional deposit was made. In fiscal year 2020 budget, as enacted, the full statutory deposit was made. And our forecast assumes that in 2021 and beyond, the statutory deposit will be made.
Good. That's good to hear. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the corporate income tax, do you have any sense of how that number would change if BP were to transfer its assets to HealthCorp?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, the BP Hillcorp transaction is incorporated into our forecast. That's as much detail as we can give at this time.
What is, if I could, Mr. Chair,
follow up?
What is that number?
Mr. Chair, if I could interject. So there are two statutes in law that require the Department of Revenue Tax Division to keep the particulars of taxpayer information and taxpayer returns confidential. And so we've been advised by the Department of Law that all we can say with respect to this transaction is that it has been modeled and included in the revenue sources book, but we can't give specific numbers because that would violate the statute.
I think to help with the question that Senator Wilkowski asked, which is a legitimate concern or legitimate item of interest to the committee, is we'll have that modeled. We know roughly the percent of ownership in the basin, and we can get some ballpark numbers to measure an impact without using any confidential, just public information to give the committee a feel for that numeric. And for those watching at home, the potential buyer of a significant portion of the assets on this in our oil basin is not a subchapter C corporation. And they have different, they're under a different tax structure, which was not contemplated in any significance in our production tax creation and implementation. But we just need to know this, get a feel for the magnitude. So we'll have that discussion, I'm sure, later on when we have some analysis run in the building by our consultants on various pieces of legislation within the building. So we should be able to get a rough idea, enough of a rough idea to make some policy conclusions, or rough conclusions.
And Mr. Chair, with respect to the introduction of legislation changing tax laws, of course the Department of Revenue will be here to provide explanation as well as fiscal impact.
And yeah, we'll work with the department, but we understand you've got confidentiality issues to deal with, and we'll work through those. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My questioning was on the same line that Senator Wilikowski was delving into. The concern that I have is that this is going to drastically change the landscape to the state of Alaska, and I'm fearful that it will set a blueprint for other majors that are on the North Slope that could devastate the revenue stream for the state of Alaska. So it is a very, very important tactic and tax law for corporations is one that they look at very, very in depth. So what we're dealing with, what is coming to light, could have major devastation to our revenue stream for the state of Alaska. So we need to take a look at this. And I guess my major concern is that we need to make sure that the playing field is equal for all of the majors that are on the North Slope. So that, I think, is something that needs to have special attention to the legislature.
I'd like to add also a little bit more complexity to the subject matter. The corporate tax rate has changed significantly since the creation and implementation of our structure, from roughly 34% to 21%, which makes a well, we'll have Department of Revenue talk about that. I would expect it to be significant changes in cash splitting arrangements, and then with this addition corporate structure applied, or we could see significant movements in cash, and we just need to be aware of it. And policy implications, if any. So it's this subject matter, I'm sure we'll go in more in depth in later meetings throughout the winter. You have a follow-up, Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, I do. Just to point out, I think what we've heard from our experts over the years, and that is that the lack of transparency that we have in the state is shocking. The fact that this is the Finance Committee and we didn't even know what the impact is of this transfer. That's just shocking to me. I mean, maybe the law needs to be changed. It sounds like it does need to be changed. But aside from that, on the corporate income tax, can you talk about the impact of having a worldwide apportionment of the corporate income tax as opposed to separate accounting?
It's not really a germane subject at the time. I think at some point in the future we could have that discussion. It's not really on point for the revenue forecast. And for those watching at home, Senator Wilikowski's asking what's the impact of the historical way the basin was first structured for tax purposes, where the expenditures were put against revenue in Alaska. The current way it's done, I think, the governor from Iliamna, Hammond, the Hammond administration, was worldwide apportionment, where they can bring in other expenditures and revenues and basically commingle.
Mr. Chair, it's a fascinating subject and an interesting episode in Alaska history, and I'm sure we could take up a whole hearing on it. We'd be happy to come and present on that. There was litigation, I'm sure, as most of the committee knows. The state ultimately prevailed in that litigation in establishing separate accounting, but by that time, we decided to adopt worldwide apportionment. As far as the shocking lack of transparency, I just feel compelled to add that violation of one of these statutes is a Class C felony. That absolutely has our attention. So maybe the law needs to be changed, but as long as the law is the way it is with respect, We're going to abide by it.
We're not going to ask the department to breach confidentiality. We understand the issue of transparency, I think, fairly well, and the concern multiple consultants for the legislature have expressed, the lack of transparency relative to other basins. But the law is the law, and we're going to follow the law, and we're not going to ask you to breach it. And when we need information that you can't deliver, we'll put it together from another direction and come up with some ballpark figures for policy. But
and we are absolutely here to support any legitimate effort with respect to changing taxes and providing information and fiscal impact.
A quick follow-up before we go to the next slide, because we're not going to debate the oil tax structure. There's a bill from one of the senators in the hopper, I'm sure, will be perking this way.
Would you support changes to the transparency laws then, so that that information could be disclosed to the people of Alaska?
I'm not going to express support or opposition. The laws are today. That's a deep policy discussion that involves balancing of interests.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to ask a question of the department. I don't need an answer today, but I would like to talk about the mining rents and royalties and the revenue forecasted, because I'm looking at the revenue sources book and the revenue is going down when we in fact just got an increase to our annual rents of, forget the percentage, so it should be, I just didn't know if you are tracking that and hadn't factored in that increase to the mining rents.
Okay. Can we continue?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, again for the record, Dan Stickle. Moving on to slide six. Slide six highlights some of the key changes to the unrestricted revenue forecast compared to the spring forecast, which was released last March. For fiscal year 2019, Alaska North Slope oil prices averaged 56 cents per barrel higher than what we had forecast in the spring forecast. However, unrestricted revenue came in about $50 million below our forecast. The primary reason for the revenue shortfall had to do with production tax revenue, which came in $140 million below the spring forecast for unrestricted revenue. The reasons for that had to do with higher than expected refunds for the 2018 tax year, and then attributing some production tax payments to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund at the year end, which reduced the unrestricted portion. For fiscal year 2020, our forecast of ANS oil price has been reduced by $2.46 per barrel, and for fiscal year 2021, the forecast has been reduced by $7 per barrel to $59 per barrel, and the lower oil price forecast is the primary reason for reductions to the revenue forecast in both of those years.
Right. We have questions on that? And a reminder to the public, these forecasts for FY21 will be updated at the end of March or in the first part of April by the department, and they may change a little bit one direction or the other. And then we'll have also several more months of the FY20 numbers going into historic column, and we'll be able to refine those pricing numbers a little bit as we go forward. Go ahead and continue.
Sure. Slide seven focuses on the permanent fund. The permanent fund is currently the largest share of unrestricted general fund revenue. This slide shows the estimated transfer to the general fund for fiscal year 19 as well as the 10-year forecast period. The transfer was $2.7 billion in fiscal year 19 and is expected to grow to $3.8 billion by fiscal year 2029. These funds are available for general appropriation or for dividends at the legislature's discretion. The transfer is based on the percent of market value of the fund, which is colloquially known as the POMV. For fiscal years 19 through 21, the POMV was 5.25% of the average market value of the first five of the last 6 years. And then for fiscal year 2022 and beyond, the transfer is 5% of that value. The permanent fund forecast is dependent on both investment returns and future oil production. The forecast is based on a long-term earnings assumption of 7% annually for the fund, as well as ongoing mineral royalty deposits of hundreds of millions of dollars annually that continue to build the fund.
And we can further this discussion when we have the permanent fund in front of us and talk about their sensitivity of their rates of return, along with what the department of feels the deposits into the fund are. And I assume the department, when they put these numbers together, are factoring in no ad hoc draws or draws in excess of the 5% rate of the percent of market value going forward. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. We have any questions on this slide? Okay. Next page.
Moving on next to the price forecast, I'm on slide 9 now. The Department of Revenue made a change to the way we do the oil price forecast this year. Previously, we used a survey approach with a group of state employees and outside experts. We had a day-long meeting in October where we got together and discussed oil market trends and came up with an oil price forecast. This approach had several issues around it. It was very time intensive. It was not terribly transparent. And by time the forecast was ultimately released, it many times was stale. And so as a result, frequently the forecast was adjusted at the last minute by the department, which further reduced the transparency around the forecast. This year, beginning with the fall 19 forecast, we've developed a methodology that uses price forecasts from the futures market for the next two fiscal years. So we actually compiled the price forecast on Monday, December 2nd this year, and we released the forecast that Friday on December 6th. So it was a very timely forecast. The forecast is based on the Brent futures prices, and it's fully documented so that anyone could replicate our forecast using the futures market. We chose Brent as our benchmark because Brent and ANS are both waterborne crudes and historically have traded very similarly in the market. There's no futures market available for ANS crude, but there is robust information in futures market for Brent crude.
Senator Wilkowski, are you done with the slide?
One more point, yeah. Mr. Chairman. Currently, ANS oil is trading at a premium to Brent of about $2 per barrel. And we acknowledged that when we were putting the forecast together. We believe that the reasons for the premium are temporary in nature. We have conservatively assumed that the differential will return to zero and the prices will trade in parity again beginning in fiscal year 2021.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Have you back-tested this new methodology to see how accurate it would have been over the last 20, 30 years?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, we have done some back testing, and we showed that the futures market methodology was at least as accurate as the previous methodology.
Okay. Next slide, please.
Slide 10 shows 4 years of historical oil prices as well as 4 years of projections from various sources. These price projections are for Brent crude and are shown in real terms, so not including inflation. In the month and a half since we prepared the price forecast, our forecast is actually still very much in line with the futures market. We actually looked at futures prices for Brent this morning, and if we were to have run the prices today, the forecast would still be $59 per barrel for fiscal year 2021. But then over the long term, we're actually a little bit higher than the futures market because we made a decision to hold prices constant after the budget year. Our forecast is slightly below the average of oil market analysts and several dollars below what the Federal Energy Information Agency is projecting. So I guess the takeaway from this comparison slide is that there's a range of price forecasts out there from the mid-50s to the mid-60s. And our forecast looks reasonable, possibly slightly conservative, but it falls within the range of forecasts.
Okay. Questions on the price forecast? Okay. Next slide, please.
That said, one thing we do know is that our forecast will probably be wrong. So slide 11 shows how unrestricted revenues would change based on different oil prices for fiscal year 2021. Our forecast is $59 per barrel, resulting in just under $2 billion of unrestricted revenue, not counting the permanent fund transfer. And around current prices, each $1 change to the oil price results in about $30 to $35 million change in unrestricted revenue over the course of a year. To get that same $30 to $35 million change from production, that would require about 10 to 15,000 barrels per day change in the production levels.
And do you want to, or does it come later, you want to talk about the switch between gross and net tax and what the expectations of the department is?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, we have a slide specific to the gross net crossover in the addendum, so.
Okay, we'll wait
for that. Moving on to slide 13 on oil production. This has already been addressed yesterday by Department of Natural Resources, but we wanted to have a couple slides in our presentation just to check that box. As a reminder, we work closely with DNR to produce our production forecast, and it does represent a most likely value within a range of possible outcomes. Slide 14 shows the North Slope actual production for fiscal year 18 and 19, as well as three cases for the 10-year forecast. The official case is what we use in our revenue forecast, which has production declining slightly over the next few years and then recovering to the 500,000 barrels per day range. As mentioned, I believe DNR mentioned this yesterday, but we have a slight difference in how we treat natural gas liquids, which are used in enhanced oil recovery. These are barrels that are produced at Prudhoe Bay and then injected in the Kuparuk Reservoir to support oil production there. We assume 10,000 barrels per day of these natural gas liquids used in this project. Our production numbers in the revenue sources book do not include these barrels because they're not delivered into TAPS and they're not considered produced for tax purposes. So when you're looking at the DNR versus DOR numbers, that's an important caveat to keep in mind. And then one other question that came up yesterday had to do with how producer data is received. So to support the revenue forecasting process, producers at existing fields provide us with detailed technical data for each field once a year, and we share that with DNR in the production forecasting process. However, for new fields that have not yet begun production, we meet with the companies, we talk to them about what's going on with their development, we get a general sense of expectations, but we don't have a detailed technical data submission from them for new fields. Moving on to costs, Mr. Chairman, I'll move to slide 16. So costs of production are tracked closely for two reasons. First, they're a barometer of company investment in the state, which leads to future production. And second, they're an integral part of the production tax calculation. Companies are allowed to deduct most cost of production in calculating their production tax liability. This includes ongoing operational costs as well as capital expenditures with no requirement for depreciation. And these costs are factored into the net tax calculation. Slide 17 shows a 10-year history and forecast of what those allowable lease expenditures are for the North Slope. Our cost forecasts are developed using several sources. One of those is detailed projections that are provided by the operators of every unit each 6 months, once for the fall forecast and once for the spring forecast. We also look at historical spending trends and public information. And when we're dealing with some of the new fields that are expected to come online, we are applying a risk factor to the costs of those fields that's in line and in agreement with what's being done on the production forecast. So looking back over the last decade, both operating and capital expenditures peaked in fiscal year 2015 and then declined with falling prices in the years following. In fiscal year 19, allowable operating expenditures were $2.9 billion, and we're expecting that to remain fairly stable with a slight decline in the next couple years and then climbing, leveling out around $3 billion by fiscal year 2024 as new fields come online. In terms of capital expenditures, in FY19, allowable capital expenditures were $2.2 billion on the North Slope. That was the first year of increases after three down years in a row. We're expecting capital expenditures to peak at $3.6 billion in fiscal year 2022, with spending on large new developments like Pica and Willow, before tapering off later in the decade. Now, these out-year numbers later in the decade, where we show capital expenditures declining, there's significant opportunity to increase those forecasts as new developments enter into the forecast and become more likely.
Could you explain to the public a little bit where you get these numbers? Is it from a Ouija board, or is it from reports from the industry, or how do you put this together, and how often is it updated?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, so the historical information come from production tax returns. Since lease expenditures are part of the calculation, we do require companies to report their operating and capital expenditures on a monthly and annual basis. For the forecast, we have another tax return that requires them to give us a five-year projection for each unit in the state, and we have that due twice a year to support the spring forecast and the fall forecast. And so that information from the companies is one of the primary sources we rely on. We also look at plans of development. We consult with DNR. We look at all of the public information that's out there about the different fields.
And these forecasted expenditures, particularly with capital expenditures, are just that. They're a forecast of a particular point in time and could change if economic conditions change in the future. No, correct. They're not locked into doing this. This is their best estimate of industry, of their particular company's activity coming, and you consolidate it and then report it back to us. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. So this represents our best estimate of spending on, and it's only for those projects that are included in the production forecast.
Okay. And when I had, just for a minute, a preview of this, along with my co-chair with the department. We'll probably revisit this slide along with the Department of Labor sometime in the future when we talk about employment, because clearly it's tied together. You need a lot more hands in the field to expense $4 billion in capital expenditures than you do $1.7 billion, as an example. And that'll have an economic impact on the state. So there'll be another layer in future presentations when we take a look at this. And we've actually asked for a look back of a decade or longer to go with the look back, or excuse me, the look forward for that very subject, or for that information on employment, good or bad. We just want to know trends and how they're historically been related and how we expect them to continue the relationship going forward. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the listening public, what is the correlation, if any, on capital expenditures versus investment for exploration?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, exploration costs are included in the capital expenditure numbers shown here.
So can we assume that after 2022 to 2029, we're going to see a $1.5 billion reduction, potentially a large portion of that in less exploration in Alaska?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, our forecast assumes a level of ongoing exploration fairly similar to what we've seen over the last couple years. The reduction in capital expenditures in the forecast primarily has to do with the fact that we're expecting a significant spend on several new developments over the next couple years, and we don't have large new developments coming into the forecast to take up that level of spending in the later years.
Is it possible to break down the senator's request on the capital expenditures into some component parts? He asked for exploration. Do you guys have that data Is that possible, so sure. We can actually see it layered?
Mr. Chairman, we do have one slide later in the addendum that provides some additional detail, but we'd be happy to follow up with as much further detail as we can provide after that.
Okay, so when we get to that slide, we'll come back to Senator Hoffman's question, and if we need more detail, we'll have you guys do what you can to help him with that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Or the committee, I should say. Okay, go ahead and continue.
Sure. Moving on to slide 18, Mr. Chairman, this chart shows a 10-year history and forecast for transportation costs in dollars per barrel. These are the costs of pipelines, including the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, as well as marine transportation, to move oil from the North Slope to market on the West Coast. Transportation costs are deducted from the gross value calculation for both tax and royalty purposes. The trend in general, transportation costs vary with production, so as volume goes down, costs on a per barrel basis go up. You'll see that costs increased steeply from fiscal year 10 through 14 as production was declining before leveling off while production held around 500,000 barrels per day. There were also some changes to how the pipeline tariffs were calculated, which contributed to the reduction that you see in fiscal year 19.
I'd like to just mention for the record that Senator Stevens joined us shortly after we started and has been busily taking notes.
Okay. And then I'm going to hand it over to Director Glover to talk about tax credits and audits.
Good morning. For the record, Colleen Glover, Tax Director from the Department of Revenue.
Okay, go ahead. You have a question before we start, Senator Bishop?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, just back on the 18 and the years 20, in 2010 through 14, would it be safe to say that Alyeska was still going through their strategic reconfiguration and that added to part of that increased cost, which in theory should be lower in our transportation costs as we go forward?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, I believe that's an accurate statement.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's a difference in the percentage and the actual dollars, the roughly $1.5 billion they spend in shipping. So, and maybe you can get back to the committee with a little further breakdown on that also, so we can get a better feel for the underlying total cost without the
sure, we'd be happy
without the additional capital expenditures on top of it, to just get an idea, a feel for it.
For the record, Colleen Glover, Tax Director. I will be talking about some subset of tax credits and the oil and gas production tax audits this morning. These tax credits on the slide here are a subset of all the tax credits, and these are only those credits that are available for purchase by the state. These are primarily oil and gas production tax credits that were available to explorers or producers that produce less than 50,000 barrels per day on average. There's also some other tax credits related to our corporate income tax that were available for purchase. Those were the gas storage, LNG storage facility, and refinery credits. All of these corporate income tax have now sunsetted at the end of 2019. This is a snapshot of what's in the balance for the FY 2020 shown on this graph. The balance at the time of the forecast was about $740 million that we had received applications for. It's a dynamic amount. There are still people that are still going to apply for new credits. They can also use credits against existing tax liability, or there could be other adjustments made to these credits. This schedule is showing the expected payout if we proceeded with the calculation as interpreted in the statute. As Commissioner Barnhill discussed earlier, there is tomorrow morning you'll have more discussion on the tax bonding program, but this is the basis, gray bars in the schedule is the basis for the calculations for discounting if we move forward with the bonding program.
So let me try to help a little bit with the explanation. I'm trying to think of the Alaskan sitting at home wondering what in the world this chart's all about. So these credits were created several years ago over a period of time. We have terminated most of them now. We have a bill pending of roughly $740 million liability that we have to pay. We have a statute on the books that gives us a minimum amount we should pay depending on price. And that amount for FY20, when you can help me with that, what would it be if we paid the bill in FY20?
So, Chair Steadman, Mike Barnhill, Acting Commissioner. For purposes of the forecast, the Economics Research Group assumed that what we would be doing is taking a break in FY20 and issuing debt so we could pay off the outstanding balance that was on the books in FY21. But let's just set that aside and assume that HB 331, which permits authorization of debt to pay it off, didn't happen. And we were in FY20 not taking a skip. Basically, what you would do is move these gray bars forward a year. And so this shows that in FY21, under the statute that you just referenced, we'd pay about $160 million. So these gray bars represent the blue bar in FY20 broken out year by year for payments under the statutory formula. The statutory formula is in 4355.028, and it calls for payment of, if the price of oil for a particular year is $60 or higher, you pay 10% of the outstanding balance. If the price of oil is $60 or lower, you pay 15%. And so that's how each of these, and you just have a declining balance year over year, and that's how these gray bars are computed.
Okay, thank you. The point as I was driving to was actually previous to those comments, because in this current year we have nothing in the budget. And if we were to pay the statutory payment for the current year, roughly what would that be?
It's, go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Dan Stickle for the record. It's somewhere between 100 and 200 million. I'd prefer to provide the committee with the exact calculation.
Okay, that's fine. Let's just say it's 150 million. Because it's just a concept. I just want the committee members to understand that the budget year we're in right now in the public, we have not paid that bill yet. If the if we do the proposal that we see laid out in front of us, issue kind of goes off the table. If it doesn't, we need to have a policy discussion at the table along with the administration on what are we going to do for the current fiscal year. That's the point. And it's also an issue, I think, that we need to be very, very clear about, that is footnoted in some of our summary documents, so our fellow colleagues in the building recognize that there's still a liability floating around in the year, good or bad. I'm not saying anything about the credit creation or any proposals going forward. There is a statute on the books that would trigger a minimum payment every year, and we need to address it.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just chime in, just sort of headline, what is the whole purpose of this for the people at home? The legislature and past administrations, observing the year-over-year decline in the North Slope production, came up with this idea of trying to attract smaller producers to come to Alaska, drill, explore, and ultimately produce. And the idea, and there's multiple programs embedded in this, but the idea generally was, if you come up, explore, incur expenses, we'll pay some portion of those expenses in cash. And from the inception of this program, the state had a practice of paying off those credits in cash roughly at the time they were presented. It came back to the legislature for appropriation. Legislature had funds that could be appropriated, and they were paid off until the price of oil collapsed in 2014. And paying them off immediately became problematic. Despite all of that, and then we went to this, there was a veto by Governor Walker down to the statutory formula amount. Despite all of the difficulties we've had, the state has always paid something in every fiscal year to pay down these incurred credits, including last year, the legislature set aside $100 million in case we couldn't get the bonding done, and we couldn't get the bonding done, so we paid $100 million on a pro rata basis to the credit holders. This year, the hope was obviously that we would be able to issue and pay down, issue debt and use the proceeds of the debt to pay down something in the range of $700 million. Unfortunately, and we can get into this more tomorrow, litigation was filed, and we are in a hold pattern until that litigation is resolved. We're hoping that the litigation will be resolved soon. We'll get some clarity about how we proceed. But the policy point that you're trying to make is, if we don't get authorization to issue so that we can issue in FY20, or we lose the litigation, this would be the first year where we don't have an appropriation to pay anything. And from a policy perspective, that is a bit of concern. Well, not a bit, it's quite a bit of concern. Because we said to the world, come to Alaska and drill, and we'll pay some of your expenses. And so there will need to be a conversation, and the administration will actively participate in that conversation about what we do in the event that we cannot issue debt to pay off the balance of these credits.
And that's the point I'm trying to draw out on this slide. It's not a discussion of credits, good, bad, or otherwise. It's a discussion of a liability that is owed by us, and we still have an open-ended question in this current fiscal year to have that resolved before we finish up our legislative cycle this year. We'll have the subject in detail coming before us again. Hopefully, if the bond mechanism goes through, it'll be pretty short and easy. If the bond mechanism fails for whatever reason, it'll be a little more labor here at the table as we try to come up with a policy solution with agreement with the legislature how we're going to deal with this, because we have to deal with it. That's the whole point. Do we have any questions, or Senator Bonimoff?
Thank you. Senator Steadman does make a good point that we do have this particular statute on the books, and we are waiting for bond, the question to be answered. But like other statutes on the books, sometimes we ignore them. We are the appropriating body. We have that choice. The question that I have right now is the $720 million or so outstanding. I was part of the 2017 effort to end the cash credit program, and in that bill, I think we passed it in October, made available allowances for a robust secondary market to purchase these credits. And what I've not seen here is, or I guess I have just haven't had the explanation, is how much, to your recall, have any of these certificates been purchased in the secondary market at a steep discount, is my understanding. Has that affected some of this $720 million outstanding balance? Is it less, I guess, is the question.
Through the chair, Senator Von Himhoff, the short answer is yes, and for the details on how many credits have been assigned, I will defer to Director Glover.
For the record, Colleen Glover, Tax Director, there has been some of that happening being sold. We don't know the value that they're sold for, and this, like I stated, the balance is dynamic. I mean, these credits can be used against a production tax liability, and we see that happening as well. So there is movement in the number. I don't have exact numbers of what has been transferred or sold. We do have a report that in statute we have to provide for the previous calendar year of which credits the state did purchase, and that will have some of that information on there of changes from last year, and that is a draft form, and hopefully we can get that out to you in the next week.
Okay.
Just very quick follow-up.
And then Senator Bishop.
Okay, so the question that I have is, let's say there's a $100 million tax certificate, and the company that holds the certificate sells it on the secondary market for $30 million. Does that face value of $100 million on your books go away because it's been satisfied on the secondary market, so that $100 million is no longer available to apply towards any production taxes owed?
So, Co-Chair Vandenhoff, if in that case, if there was a $100 million tax credit certificate sold to another party, the value of that certificate is still $100 million, regardless of what they sold it for. And that person can use, whoever they transferred or sold it to, can use that to offset their production tax liability. So it would, if in that situation, that $100 million would reduce that value from $740 to $640 that's available for purchase.
If they put it, if I could follow, if they put it to the Treasury, if they put it against their tax liability, so the net cash position of the state still goes backwards $100 million, correct?
Mr. Chairman, correct. It's just from a different kind of bucket, but it right. would not be available for purchase.
Correct. We have, I think, Senator Bishop and then Senator Wilkowski.
Just briefly, I appreciate the way the conversation is going from the chair and what I'm hearing from the administration, because I have constituents that are owed, and I'm glad to see we're working to find a solution, because we need to continue forward. If you back up three slides, to continue to have a robust capital expenditures going forward in Alaska's future.
Right. I think there's been some firms that have gone insolvent over the issue.
Yes.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. The tax credit statute is purely a discretionary statute. It says the legislature may appropriate a certain amount, the tax director may issue certificates for those amount, and you consider those a debt. You've got several slides on those. And I'm just curious if you consider the unpaid permanent fund dividend checks, which are a mandatory statute, which say the legislature shall pay these amounts. Does the department or does the administration consider those to be debts that need to be paid to Alaskans?
Mr. Chair.
It's not a germane question again, but we're mixing policies with, we're trying to talk here about revenue, but the deputy commissioner might want to give us a brief response.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. I think the whole dynamic and context of our discussions around this table and around the state of Alaska for the past 4 years since the price of oil dropped has been, how do we deal with these statutes that on their face suggest payment of certain amounts, permanent fund dividends, tax credits, PERS-TERS liability, Medicaid. We don't have enough money to pay all of them. And so we as a state, as a committee, as an administration are trying to figure a way forward. We've had protracted discussion, debate, controversy, that will continue. The administration's view, Governor Dunleavy, I mean, you know this, I'll just repeat it, Governor Dunleavy believes quite passionately that the state should follow the law with respect to computation of permanent fund dividends. We continue that discussion. Governor Dunleavy is not opposed to a change in the permanent fund dividend statutes, but he would like that to be approved by a vote of the people.
So
all of these issues are on the table.
Let's stop here.
Okay.
We're going to not get sidetracked. We're going to stay on the revenue source of subject. If we want to have a future meeting on policy calls and policy differences, we can schedule one as the committee members want and go into great depth on those differences. But right now we're talking about our revenue, liabilities that
are tied in with our mining, gas, oil arenas, so we can get a better feel for what kind of revenue we are going to have in the current fiscal year and the next fiscal year through our budget cycle. We'll have plenty of time for some of these other subject matters. We're only in about the third day. Mr. Deputy Commissioner, do we have any other questions on this slide before we go to the next one? It is an issue I wanted to thank the department on for bringing the slide forward. We went over it in the office quite a bit. It's a subject that's not fun to talk about, the liability that we still face for this current fiscal year, but I wanted the committee members to have that in the back of their mind when the supplemental budget that's going to be hit on the 15th of February probably or thereabouts, and the amount of impact it may or may not have in the upcoming fiscal year. So it's significant. That's why it needed to be on the table today. Next slide, please.
So for the record, Colleen Glover, we've already discussed slide 21, so we'll just move on to the next subject, which is the oil and gas production tax audits on slide 23. Just to give you an update from last year, how we're progressing with the backlog of these audits. We did complete the 2013 audits. We're in the middle of the 2014 audit cycle right now. We've made great improvements in the process in the last year. One of the best benefits to make things to streamline has been the implementation of our tax revenue management system, our TRIMS. That has enabled us to automate and have data within the system that is the actual data from the tax return. So 2014 tax return is the first year that the oil and gas production tax returns are in the system. So instead of having to create work papers by hand, we can export those work papers to compare against the return and to do analysis on that. It has definitely made an improvement on our efficiency and less work for us for the 2014 audits. Another big change was kind of having a more organized, thought out audit plan. We have documented audit plans with every taxpayer. We had engagement meetings with each taxpayer, reviewed the audit plans, came to agreement on timelines, communication protocols, scope, contacts, and that has been doing very well for us. It's been very rewarding for me to get positive feedback from the taxpayers, at least for the process, right? We understand taxpayers probably don't appreciate audits, but at least is the process is professional and has effective communication. It helps that relationship. So we've seen great strides in our process and our communications, which is two-way, and so we're getting better response with data requests too from the taxpayers. We are working to get into a three-year audit cycle, which is in line, just for your information, all of our other taxes have a three-year statute of limitation on audits, except for the oil and gas production tax audits. So it is unique that it has a six-year statute. 6 years is a long time, and unfortunately causes problems when you're trying to get data from companies and from 6 years ago, and a lot of change in personnel, it's hard to get the data and people aren't around to answer questions from that time. So getting into more current cycle will pay dividends for us as well as far as information gathering.
So is there a difference in the workload to do an audit when you have a price below the trigger point of the net profits and you're in the gross tax calculation? Does that accelerate the ability of the department to do audits?
Yeah, Chairman Stedman, correct. And so part of the reason why you'll see we plan to do the 2015, 16, and 17 audits together in kind of a consolidated fashion, as those years the majority of the taxpayers were in a minimum tax, gross tax situation. When you're in a gross tax situation, the lease expenditures really aren't a factor of that. And auditing the lease expenditures is the bulk of the time and energy spent in our audits and the majority of the transactions. So we do think that those years of minimum tax will reduce the time to do audits, and it will help us actually catch up on our audits.
So the years that the industry, all of them or most of them or what have you, are in the minimum tax calculation, does the department save the data on capital and operating expenditures for future use and keeping track of what's going on in the basin?
Chairman Stedman, as Mr. Stuckel had talked about before, that information is reported monthly to us, so we do have that within our system, so we still have access to that.
Right. And will the department be considering bringing forward, or is there interest from the Department of the Administration, I should say, in shortening the audit timeline to 3 years? Or is that something the committee should expect, or is it just kind of an offhand comment that it would be nice to have?
Through the chair, or Mr. Chair, Mike Barnhill again. From a policy perspective, we think 3 years is absolutely appropriate, and it's a target that we're going to continue to try our best to adhere to going forward. As a legislative matter, we think it's worthy of consideration. We don't have a bill, but we think going forward, particularly if we can really adhere to the 3 years, it's worthy of having a discussion with this committee and with the industry about tightening that timeline up to 3 years.
Yeah, well, maybe we can work on that going forward and have something to do next winter in case we run out of things to do this winter.
Sounds good.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Glover, for trying to keep on track on our estimated time goals and our audits. Can you tell us about how much was from the last year's audits have been deposited into the CBR?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, if you look in the revenue sources book, there is information in there about tax and royalty settlements aggregated together that are deposited to the CBRF. It is in table 2-3 in the revenue sources book. For FY19, there was $181 million deposited into the CBRF, which primarily tax, but there is some royalty. Our forecast for FY20 is $200 million for tax and royalty settlements to the CBRF.
We have a follow-up, Senator Wilson.
No, I just wanted to get that on the record for some folks. Just may not understand that the tax credits that are owed so automatically get deposited back into the CBR, and just trying to see what the outstanding balance of that potential could be as well.
Right, and we'll be hearing from our auditor in the future too on some of these issues, and we've got some clarity heading in that direction and some work to do there also.
That is all I had with audits, unless there's other questions. And the next was circling back on some of the addendum slides that were requested by the committee.
Okay. We have any further questions? I think we've got some subject matters that were brought up by Senator Wilikowski. That it was nice that Senator Wilikowski brought them up, because they're going to be coming up later on in the year, which gives the department kind of a heads up to try to do some work when they have time. There is legislation in the building that will most likely be at the table later on, and there's a referendum in front of the people. So the committee will be spending some time trying to understand that issue, to help the public understand the issue, pros and cons, so we have a feel for what the complexity is and the potential outcome. And we'll work with Senator Wilikowski on the items he brought up and when they fit into the schedule of the committee. So there's some continuity and makes it easier for everybody to follow the complexity of all the issues and how they're intertwined. Because there's good points and bad points in most of these issues, and we need to understand both sides of it and down the middle. We have any further questions, concerns from the committee members or comments from the guests today at the head of the table?
Mr. Chair, I just want to express thanks to the committee for the conversation today. And I also want to say that all of the questions today are good questions. We have a very complicated situation in front of us. The Department of Revenue and the administration looks forward to supporting this committee's efforts in any way that we can, through education, through information, through good, vigorous debate and discussion. So thank you.
Yes, Will, I had a preliminary conversation with our consultant yesterday, very preliminary, in some of the complexities and the difficulty in modeling. I think the point brought out earlier today that some of the confidentiality that cloaks our basin is going to make modeling somewhat challenging, and they're going to be doing some modeling of it and asking for a range, I think, of comfort from the industry and the state, so we can have an understanding of what's the subject matter and the impact of the subject in front of us. It's not going to be as simple as adding a column of arithmetic in any way, shape, or form. But if we can get a banded range that's fairly tight, hopefully we can get a feel for the policy implications. And then the discussion of disclosure, I'm sure will be coming up later on in legislation and so on and so forth. So for tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., we're going to hear a state debt summary and credit review. Some of this will be repeated. Some of it is going to go into more depth with the credits, because it'll be more germane to the schedule tomorrow. So those that there's an addendum. There's some more slides.
Mr. Chairman, we do have an additional 11 slides that were put in as an addendum. We'd be happy to speak to those now.
Sure, I don't want to get out of Dodge, so I stop. But we can skip that slide and continue on, because we have a few minutes, and I do apologize.
Sure. All right, again, for the record, Dan Stickle. Again, we had a few additional slides that we tacked on to the end here as an addendum in response to some committee requests. Slide 26, we were asked to show a history of ANS transportation costs as far back as readily available. There's two lines on this chart. The blue line shows average transportation costs in real terms, excluding inflation. You see that transportation costs were fairly stable from the 1990s through 2011, and then increased in the 2011 through 2014 timeframe, and have been coming back down a little bit since then. Another interesting way of looking at this is transportation costs as a share of the ANS price, which is what we're showing on the orange bar here. From 2005 through 14, which were the higher price years, transportation costs accounted for less than 10% of the ANS price. But now that prices are in a lower price regime, we've been above that level for the last several years.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah. Why that big spike from 2014 to 2016?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, part of the increase in costs, if you go back from the 2010 timeframe, was reduced production. You had lower production, which increased the cost of transportation on a per barrel basis. There was also some general price inflation around the oil industry as a whole, as oil prices were going up. So you had kind of a situation where you had higher oil prices that were increasing costs across the board, combined with lower production. Slide 27, we were asked to look at how our projections for capital and operating costs have done historically. So this chart shows a 13 years of historical North Slope capital expenditures, as well as the two-year forecast of CapEx made each fall. In general, what we've learned is that capital expenditures tend to come in a little bit lower than what we project as projects get scaled back or delayed. It also appears that capital spending is a budget allowance that companies try not to exceed. So historically, capital expenditures have come in a little below forecast. Slide 28 is a similar chart for operating expenditures. And what we've seen on the operating expenditure side is that costs tend to come in a little bit higher than projected. It looks like operating costs are more of a target that companies try to realize but sometimes have trouble achieving. Even before putting these slides together, this is kind of a trend on both of the types of costs that we've been aware of, and we've made some adjustments to how we prepare our capital and operating expenditure forecasts to hopefully do a little bit better job going forward.
Mr. Stickle, on the request for these charts, wasn't to express a concern that the department do a better job going forward. I think the department's done a good job. It's just always nice to see the projection versus reality. And these charts were basically defaulted out of dealing with the PERS and TERS issue, where we had multiple forecasts that weren't even close. So I think the department's done a very good job. I wish you had a perfect Ouija board. We'd be working 3-4 years out in front of us, but you're doing fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide 29, we were requested to provide information about North Slope industry employment. So we reached out to the research and analysis section over at Department of Labor, and they provided the data for this chart, which is looking specifically at employment in the North Slope oil patch. Employment grew from about 6,000 in 2004 to over 12,000 in 2014 and 2015. Then dropped for several years in a row to a little over 8,000 people in 2018. And the trend that we see here, as was pointed out earlier, is very similar to the trend that we've seen with capital spending, with the peak in 2015 and several years of decline. And like with capital spending, preliminary 2019 data suggests the first year of increase in North Slope oil industry employment for several years. And based on our projections of increasing capital spend in the next several years, there's definitely reason for optimism about what future North Slope oil employment will look like. Slide 30, Mr. Chairman, has a lot of words on it. We were requested to summarize the provisions regarding the gross value reduction, or GVR. This is a provision of the production tax law originally passed as part of SB 21 in 2013. The GVR provides a tax incentive for new field development. Generally, GVR applies to new units or new participating areas. There was transition language in the statute that allowed certain fields that came online around when SB 21 was passed to qualify. The GVR allows a company to exclude 20 or 30% of the gross value at point of production from the net production tax calculation, effectively reducing their production tax liability for companies that have those new fields. The GVR is available for the first 7 years of production and ends early if ANS prices average above $70 per barrel for any 3 years. GVR oil also receives a flat $5 per taxable barrel credit rather than the sliding credit available for most North Slope production, and that credit can, as a further incentive, can be applied to reduce tax liability below the minimum tax floor, assuming that the producer does not seek to apply any sliding scale credit below the tax floor. And this GVR will get into more detail in our order of operations presentation later in session.
Okay. Do we have questions on this? Just as a heads up, I know we'll go into it in more detail in the order of operations, but when the legislation and or we have the referendum discussion at the table, it appears, and I'm no expert on that referendum, but it appears it bifurcates the legacy fields versus the outlying, the newer fields. And if that is in fact true, we're going to have to make sure we bifurcate out the analysis. And I'd also like to remind the committee, yesterday we had a production forecast showing the newer fields coming out in front of us to keep the production fairly flat. Those new production areas have different royalty rates, and they come under the GVR. That's what I'd expect, most of the gross value reduction. So we're going to have to recognize that when we look at future revenue. I'm not saying it's good, bad, or otherwise. I'm just wanting the community to be able to count the dollars at the table. So we'll be asking the department for help in separating that and then combining the legacy fields with the newer fields, much like the slides were yesterday on just production. So we'll try to turn those into dollars so we can see the physical impact along with the physical impact of more oil down the pipeline, which helps lower the tariff regardless of where the oil comes from. So just trying to give you a heads up, the department, that we're going to need some assistance in that area, both for legislation and for just the informational discussion at some point when the committee has that. Because somebody has to lay out the referendum discussion or issues, financial implications. And clearly we should understand it at the table. Good or bad, conclude that after the fact. But clearly there's a potential to be impacted, and you need to understand it. Just before you go on to slide 31, just for table entertainment, the chairman asked for these slides, and I was ready to stop the meeting on the end of the slide when it says the meeting was over before we got to the slides that we had discussed in the office for modification or inclusion. So I apologize for that. Mr. Stickle.
It's all right. I was happy to go grab a cup of coffee and get out of here, but happy to present these as well. Moving on to slide 31, and this may get at some of the earlier questioning from Senator Hoffman. We were asked to show historical and forecast North Slope lease expenditures, including breaking out GVR and non-GVR eligible oil. So what we've done on this slide is we've shown a 10-year history and forecast. We've put producing non-GVR eligible units, which are the more mature fields, and we've put that in one category, and then all other spending in another category. And the other spending is going to include the newer fields that are eligible for GVR, as well as all exploration and development costs. And what you'll see is a majority of the historical spending has been for the existing fields. Going forward, the new fields are expected to make up a large portion of capital expenditures, more than half of the capital expenditures in the 2021 through 2024 timeframe are for these new developments that are underway.
Okay, we have questions that, okay, we'll go to the next slide, and we'll add on to this slide and this information as we roll forward in these other future presentations of the breakdown, turning it into estimated revenue or fiscal impacts, I should say.
On slide 32, we were asked to address potential impacts on ANS oil prices from new marine fuel regulations known as IMO 2020. IMO stands for International Maritime Organization. IMO 2020 is a requirement for lower sulfur fuel to be used in shipping and other maritime transportation that took effect January 1st of this year. ANS crude is not technically a low sulfur crude, though it is lower than most and can be easily mixed with low sulfur crudes in the refining process. And from experts that we've talked to, the thinking is that ANS is relatively more valuable due to IMO 2020. Refiners have been scrambling to meet demand for the new low sulfur fuel, and ANS has been trading at a premium to Brent of about $2 a barrel. IMO is part of the reason for the current ANS premium, but also low production of ANS as well as competing crudes, such as those coming from Iran and Venezuela, have created a bit of a supply crunch on the West Coast market. So between the supply issues and IMO 2020, we expect that markets should eventually normalize and ANS will trade around parity with Brent over the long term. In our forecast, we have that ANS premium returning to zero by July.
Okay.
Slide 33, this is where we talk about the gross net tax crossover. We were asked about the crossover point in the production tax calculation. This is the point where the 35% net tax after deducting per taxable barrel credits exceeds the 4% gross tax floor. So the exact crossover point varies for each company. What we're presenting here is an aggregated calculation. In the spring forecast, we estimated a crossover point in the mid-60s. This was based on spring forecast production and expected spending for fiscal year 2020. Now, in the fall forecast, we are estimating a crossover point approaching $80 per barrel. This is based on slightly lower production as well as significantly higher spending, and it's for fiscal year 2021. As a result, we expect that the minimum tax floor will exceed the net tax calculation for all years of the 10-year tax forecast in aggregate. Higher spending by the companies, while it allows companies to reduce their net tax calculation in the near term, it's ultimately good news for Alaska because it represents investment in future production.
On this slide, at some point it'd be nice to convert the breakover point with a comparative slide on the production tax value. As we watch the production tax value go up, where in dollars that is on the production tax value. Be pretty easy to do. So.
Sure. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to provide that.
Yes. Senator Bonimoff.
Thank you. Do you have by chance a model that, because the blue I'm assuming is the revenue to the state aggregate under the production tax. Do you have a model that if price goes up or down, or actually it's more of if CapEx goes up by 10% or down by 10%, or even operations cost, transportation, those assumptions, can you see how that might affect the blue, if you will? The point is you have a slope that's relatively consistent. So I infer and interpret that our current tax structure allows for some wiggle room of expenditures, additional expenditures and so forth, but allows a consistent growth at the various different prices. Does it become steeper or shallower based on different assumptions? And then that makes you believe, or that makes me think that, you know, you want to look at our tax structure. So it's something that we've got bills being introduced. We have a initiative referendum. I don't even know what it's called at this point. But do you have a model, or is there something that we can show that's like slightly dynamic on this?
Sure. Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair. If I'm understanding the question, it has to do with the sensitivity of this revenue line to company spending. Mm-hmm. And the sensitivity is going to be more pronounced once you go above this crossover point. That's where the net tax calculation is driving state revenue. But then the crossover point itself is also sensitive to company spending. So maybe what we could do is provide a couple charts looking at what this would look like with higher or lower spending.
Yes, what you can help Senator Nemo, what moves that point? And as I recall, we spent a lot of time talking about this break-even point in the 50s and early 60s. And now the committee is seeing it pushing 80 into the net profit arena versus the gross tax. And it would be helpful to have a couple of sensitivity tables run so we can see what factors move that, and committee members would be more comfortable in understanding what the drivers is. And as you had mentioned, it's one of the most significant ones is expenditures relative to the revenue.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we'll be happy to put a couple tables together. Ultimately, the crossover point is a function of production and spending. And so what we've seen from fiscal year 20 to 21 is we have both lower production and higher spending, and those work together to increase mm-hmm. that crossover point.
Yes, go ahead, follow up.
So, thank you. I think that was, thank you for making that point. We are in a zone of pre-production. We saw yesterday however many more barrels expected to come online. So we are in a higher spend, lower production, but yesterday's estimates show pending probably in the next 24 months that fruits of the labor, fruits of the investment to come online. So that would be interesting to see how that changes after all that comes online, maybe.
Mr. Stickle can do a double sensitivity table pretty quick on his machine, I can assure you. So, are there questions on this? It's, I think, fairly new information to the committee as far as the break-even point moving. So we'll come with a better understanding of that issue, what drives it, and the impact of the GVR fields and expenditures, and that weighted difference between the legacy and the GVR fields. And, Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, just I mean the initiative only applies to the three legacy fields, so it shouldn't affect the internal rate of return, the net present value of any of the new developments, as I understand it. But I'd be curious if you have a different opinion, if you could provide that to us, the impacts of the net present value, internal rate of return, cash flows, other financial metrics for other than the legacy fields, because it only affects the legacy fields. I'd be interested if there was some kind of difference in that.
I think that's a good point, but let's have them bring back the response when we have that subject right in front of us. Otherwise, it'll be, you know, there'll be a lot of other information that's probably going to be pertinent to it. So let's put that in the queue as far as one of the questions when we have that subject, you know, up at the table. How does that sound? Any other questions on the break-even chart with production and expenditures? And okay. And we might come up again on the order of operations also, though. But it would be a good time, Mr. Stickle, to bring back that sensitivity table.
Okay.
Pardon me?
On just the production tax.
Yeah, on the production tax, which is, yeah.
Moving on to slide 34, Mr. Chairman, this is our count the cash slide. We were asked to summarize all sources of petroleum revenue and then try to show an illustration of the net-net to the state treasury by backing out tax credits as well as the potential value of any carried forward lease expenditures earned. So the carried forward lease expenditures are a provision of the production tax that allows companies to use a loss in a given year to then offset a tax liability in future years. So looking at, and we've done this for fiscal year 18 and 19 historically, and then for 20 and 21 forecast. For example, looking at fiscal year 2021, total petroleum revenue from the various sources is estimated at about $1.8 billion. But assuming the statutory appropriation for tax credits and estimating a value of carried forward lease expenditures earned, the net impact on the fiscal system under this illustration might be $1.2 billion positive to the state. This is just an illustration, and for the carried forward lease expenditures, what we've done here is we've valued them at the 35% net tax rate. So the actual value to companies might be less than that.
And the reason I asked for this chart, and we went to quite a bit of discussion how to depict it, and I'm not quite sure we even are there where they're yet, but in any given year, we can use FY21, take a look at your revenue generated, net revenue, and then subtract the credits that are going to be, or any outflows, frankly, in the petroleum arena to get the net cash on the table. The challenge is we have carry forwards, and they impact the year in which they're put to the Treasury. So I asked them to run a table that all expenditures in a fiscal year generated in that fiscal year are put to the Treasury that year. In other words, every year is a net zero. Every year there's no carry forward. And then we know that isn't actual reality, because some of those expenditures need to be carried forward until there's production, and they're going to be used in the future. But the interest is to understand whatever policies we create or whatever policies we have, what they are on the net cash to the state, so there is no surprises. Because that's an attempt, and we'll probably work on, you know, maybe changing this layout a little bit. For instance, the negative $462 million, that's the, as I interpret this, that's the carry forward as if they were paid off in that given year. And we know that's not going to happen, because they're not going to be put to the Treasury. There was an interest in showing every year in a silo, and then what we'd actually expect with the carry forwards. So, Senator Hoffman, could you help me with this?
Well, I think another column or an interesting sideline would be after you have your petroleum revenue to the state under net, since there is a difference of oil barrel flow through the pipeline, it would be interesting to see what that profit would be per barrel. I think that would be interesting to the committee and to Alaskans in general.
So you want the total petroleum revenue, and then the bottom line, the total petroleum revenue, the net from above, both put in per barrel?
Yes.
Okay, that's pretty easy for him to do.
Happy to do that, Mr. Chairman.
And we'll work with the committee members on how to depict this. It's, you know, I don't want to overcomplicate things, but it's just how do we see the impacts of all our expenditures and all our revenues, and what actual cash is on the table? Because we can't spend what we don't have.
Mr. Chairman, continuing on, slide 35 is just a graphical form of illustration of slide 34, where we show the addition of the various sources of cash coming into the state, and then an illustration of the value of potential offsets to that.
Okay. So this, if I'm not mistaken, this chart then would directly reflect to the final column on the previous slide.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. So, and one of the concerns I have when we try to depict this, for instance, we can't take the $730 million we owe in the previous tax credits that were accumulated in any given year, because it just distorts everything. Because we've got these, so we got to. That's why I thought it'd be better to do it, take each year and silo it. And then we could add up the negatives or positives, and then have each year as it's laid out in accumulation. Because we're facing issues that have significant impact on the Treasury, and we don't want to be blindsided or thinking it's doom and gloom when when the sun is coming over the horizon. So I guess we'll go to the next slide with questions.
36, which is the final slide of the addendum. This is a slide that we've shown in committees before. There's some questions that came up yesterday surrounding the state's share of revenue from different land types. The basic concept is not all oil is the same. So this chart shows the various categories of land in Alaska and how royalties and taxes apply in each category of land. Production tax, corporate tax, and property tax all of those tax sources apply to all land within the state and within 3 miles of offshore, regardless of the owner of the land. On the royalty side of things, however, there's different provisions for the different categories of land ownership. I'd be happy to walk through those, or they're up on the screen.
I think the committee's probably fine with just having the table in front of us. Any member want them to walk through that? We've gone through it, and we're fine. I think I appreciate the slide. It's an easy little pin-up in the office to help us keep track when we look at across the geographical layout of the state, because all oil is not created equal, and we need to have the legislature understand that. Well, Alaskans understand that. So I think the next slide doesn't exist, so are we truly at the end, Mr. Stickle?
Yes, sir, unless there's any further questions.
I know you tried to get out early by the help of the chairman, but I do appreciate the heads up that I was a little robust when I saw the end, the last slide being the end. Tomorrow we'll continue on with the state debt summary and credit review at 9 a.m. Appreciate Department of Revenue coming forward, and we'll give you as much advance notice as possible on our questions and time to make the presentations on some of these subjects, because I know you have other duties assigned other than Senate Finance Committee, but we'll probably have some fairly in-depth questions coming that'll take, we'll need some help with some analysis. With that, we are adjourned.